really anywhere where we face uncertainty in our lives and risk in our lives. And it doesn't have to be terrorism. It could be the next business cycle, or it could be the risk of starting a new classroom for the semester. That's an area where we can learn from how nature has dealt with uncertainty and risk for 3.5 billion years.
And nature has dealt with this by being immensely adaptable.
Exactly. Right? It's all about how adaptable you are. The very first thing is, both in being adaptable and learning how to be adaptable, is to observe the world, really to look at the natural world in a whole new light, really as a source of wisdom for us, but then look at how do all these natural organisms, without any ability to plan or make predictions of the future, become so adaptable to whatever comes around.
And the octopus, of course, is a prime example of this.
Yeah, the octopus is my favorite example of it, because the octopus, surprisingly to a lot of people, is not unlike us in the sense that it has a really smart, intelligent brain, but it doesn't necessarily let its brain get in the way of its ability to adapt quickly if it needs to adapt almost instantaneously. It has ways of doing that. So it nicely balances its kind of central controller, its mind, its brain, with this very quick ability to adapt and change.
You've also written, though, that we should not expect perfection, or that we can completely eliminate risk. And certainly that's what we see in nature as well. I mean, there are some who don't survive.
Yeah, that is true. But the really important lesson from nature, if you look at the whole sweep of life, which has spread over the earth and done so many remarkable things, is every one of those life forms doesn't have any sense of trying to be perfect. I sometimes hear on television about the great white shark being nature's perfect predator, and I always laugh and say, well, you know, it would be a lot better if it had laser beam eyes to stun its prey. There's really no way to even measure perfection in nature, and we tend to focus too much on trying to find perfect solutions to things.
Nature winning the global war on terrorism.
Exactly. Trying to win a war on terrorism or a war on drugs. In my own field of ecology, we have a war on invasive species. These are just general risks that are out there, and we have to learn to live with them. I say that a fish doesn't try to turn a shark into a vegetarian. It learns that it has to deal with predation in its world, and it learns that by becoming adaptable.
I can't help noting, Dr. Sagarin, that your call to observe nature comes at a time when humans are ever more distanced from the natural world.
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing where, unfortunately, both as adults and more in our children, we're distancing ourselves from that just daily practice of going out, looking at nature, seeing complex systems. You cannot replicate the complexity of nature in a binary, computerized, screen-based system. No matter how good your resolution is on your latest generation iPhone or Android, you're not going to see the complexity that you see just by walking around in nature. And by doing that, by being out there and living in this complexity, we learn to become observers of patterns in a complex world. And that is the very first step that any organism or any organization has to do to become adaptable. Now, I will say this, that technology is giving us an advantage in being able to see and connect more and more observations around the world so that we can get a lot of information about our changing world by activating a lot of people around the world to look at change, or people that are closest to the change. And it's a lot of what we talk about in adaptability, is decentralizing the way that you respond to a change or a problem. And this is exactly what the octopus does when it camouflages itself, has all its different skin cells, each individually responding. This is what our immune system does. All our immune systems are running, cells are running around looking for invaders and responding to them without really any conference calls to our brain.
But certainly part of your message is that we need to close that distance that we have with nature as much as we can, or we're not going to get that education.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nature is the biggest source, the biggest database, if you will, on information about how to be adaptable. There's nothing even close. You can look at all the business case studies in the world, and they wouldn't make up a tiny fraction of all the case studies that nature has on how to be adaptable. So the more we distance ourselves from that, the more it's to our detriment because we're losing that really rich source of information.
You've also written that, quote, we are losing our ability to connect, empathize, and understand the complexity of other people.
Yeah, and I think that is also, you know, a function of separating ourselves. And what I really think we need to look at is, again, not, I never think about kind of total or perfect solutions, getting rid of all our screens and going back to nature and that kind of thing, because there's been a lot of benefit, of course, from all this technology. And the idea is, how can you merge these incredible new technologies we have with this more organic and deeply evolved sense we have of connecting to nature? And I think there are lots of ways to do that. We're talking about different programs you can do with kids that both let them use this technology, but also get them out into nature. So there are really great websites out there like Project NOAA, where kids, like my daughter loves going there. She'll go out on a hike, maybe photograph a snake that she's never seen before, put it up on the website, and within minutes, someone from around the world, a herpetologist, is saying, oh, that's a, you know, rare tiger rattlesnake or something. And so it connects her to all kinds of expertise, but it also keeps her wanting to go out into nature and seeing things.
What can we learn from nature, if anything, about communication? Because that seems to be a huge, huge issue for us. Certainly the federal government shutdown would be one prime example of a poor communication.
Yeah, there is so much to learn because nature is constantly communicating in all kinds of ways at every level, at the cellular level, at the individual level, between individuals, and really interestingly, between individuals that you would think wouldn't want to communicate, like prey and predators are constantly communicating to one another. Prey species are constantly looking out for predators and then actually talking to predators when they see them. And that sets up an exchange and says, you know what, I see you're there. Don't waste your time and energy trying to eat me. And it's usually a good enough signal that the predator will go somewhere else. But what's really interesting is that a lot of species, prey species, learn how to communicate to their predators in the predator's language. So there's this great example of a ground squirrel that will scream to a hawk or a coyote to say, I know you're there, but it won't scream to a snake because snakes don't hear, and it'll actually puff up its tail in kind of this menacing way. But if the snake is a rattlesnake, and only if it's a rattlesnake, it also heats up its tail because rattlesnakes see in infrared. So you're talking about a prey species that has learned to speak the language of its enemies. And we really do a poor job of this. We really don't take the time to understand the language of our adversaries and try to communicate in that way to them. And just one really blatant example is after we killed Osama bin Laden, we released videotapes that supposedly showed how pathetic this guy was in his house. And all the newspapers in the West picked it up and said, you know, images of Osama show how frail and vain and, you know, basically what a loser he was. We're trying to not let this guy become a martyr. Well, the Muslim world, especially the radical Muslim world, saw these videos and it reinforced every heroic image they had of this guy. Because where we saw this pathetic, disheveled loser, they saw a man who kept his beard even though he was supposed to be in disguise, a man who lived in humble circumstances even though he was rich. He was bobbing up and down in this way that we thought of as kind of freakish, and they saw as a devotional prayer kind of movement. So every signal we sent reinforced this idea of him as a martyr rather than the message we wanted to send, because we didn't send it in their language. We sent it in our language.
It's a fascinating field, and I have been speaking with Dr. Rafe Sagarin, who is an associate scientist and marine ecologist at the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona and part of the Biosphere 2 there as well. Dr. Sagarin, thank you so much. Really fascinating conversation, fascinating research.
Yeah, it's been great to be up here in Montana. I appreciate it. Thank you.